I shot my friends with BB guns. You know, this was a necessary part of my life and my formation. And I told the kids, I'm gonna describe the shooting of my friends with BB guns, not prescribe it. Okay, so I'm not giving permission necessarily. All right, welcome back. My name is Jason Craig. This is the Till and Keep podcast, where we discuss, like all podcasts claim to do, the intersection of stuff and things, particularly how many of us are trying to recover the idea of having, you know, a home that's actually a household that's functioning as a place of meaning and purpose. And for a lot of us, that means a place of education. I know a lot of, for myself, we homeschool our kids, sorts of challenges because I did not grow up homeschooling. I don't know what I'm doing. I didn't grow up Catholic. I don't know what I'm doing. I didn't grow up farming. I don't know what I'm doing. But I did grow up as a kid, in the 90s. And I have, there's a danger of too much, introspection and navel gazing, perhaps when you're in the 90s and now. You're realizing that was some kind of unique era, which I didn't begin realizing until I heard that the show Friends was like still some sort of massive sensation amongst people. The explanation being that it depicted a group of friends in a sitcom that didn't have cell phones and lived in some sort of approximate location to one another. And, you know, maintain friendships without media, but still it looked kind of modern and hip and cool. And Jennifer Aniston was beautiful, and that helps the show. The 90s seemed to be some sort of strange bridge to a whole new world that we now live in. And that has to do with the guests I have today, Jordan Almanzar. Am I saying that right, Jordan?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Oh man, nailed it. All right. We didn't even practice that. As I've been thinking about growing up in the 90s, it comes to the fore a lot when people call me a millennial. Now, I think there is some sort of technicality that I am because I was born in 1984. However, up through high school, I did not have social media and cell phones. Whereas now when someone thinks millennial, they think saturated in technology, which now there wasn't time but we weren't saturated. I mean, I remember in school going to the library and they're saying, hey, we have this thing called the internet. Then we all gathered around this giant screen, which was somehow supposed to be better than Oregon Trail, which it wasn't, while we watched for like 30 minutes while a pixelated giraffe slowly revealed itself on the screen. And I thought, I'm going to go get a book and look at a draft. This thing's never going to take off. My experience of high school, my experience of adolescence without the ubiquitous, just complete takeover of media was something different. And also, our guest is going to help us to consider why was there was like the 60s recognizable, the 70s recognizable in dress and music, the 80s recognizable in dress and music, even the 90s recognizable in dress and music. And now there's just this constant thing that's like sort of metastasized into this giant mass culture, that mass media and pop and all that stuff. So we're going to get into that. But most importantly, my guest today, he wrote a book called When the Earth Was Flat, One Boy's Life at the Edge of the Millennium. If you're a subscriber to Sword and Spade, we actually sent this book out to subscribers. That's how to all of them, or to the guild subscribers, because I read this and I felt like someone has written for the 90s kid who has seen something pass away from the earth. I think what this book is sort of our little house books. So if any of you read the little house books to your kids, like Little House on the Prairie, whatever, little, you know, Cabin in the Woods or Farmer Boy, we read all of them. Farmer Boy is our favorite because we have more boys, and that's the only one that's kind of masculine, has a boy in it. It tells of an era that you really can't understand our country, I think, without kind of grasping what the little house books, like their life, And that's why we read it with a certain, with a good form of nostalgia, that we would not be who we are without the people that are represented in this book. At the same time, and looking at it romantically and all of that, but at the same time, recognizing this has passed. Something has passed on from that way of life. Jordan, I think you have written the book for the 90s kid that recognizes you have to read this or at least this is how I felt in my house. Reading this book was, I'm going to pass this on to my family so that they sort of understand something that I grew up in that has now passed away. And we didn't grow up the same. I mean, I very different neighborhoods, but I shot my friends with BB guns. You know, this was a necessary part of my life and my formation. And I told the kids, I'm going to describe the shooting of my friends with BB guns, not prescribe it. Okay. So I'm not giving permission necessarily. But I do want to talk about it. But this, your book talks about really us growing up, and we're in the new era, the new, order of things. But this is, I mean, it's essentially pre-internet, and not just the internet as a tool, but what it has done to the world of entertainment, culture, all that stuff. So with that being said, before I start asking you about the book, Dr. Almanzar, I don't know anything about you now. I've only read this book, but I read on the back of it, a distinguished instructor of classical languages, longtime faculty member of Colby Academy, et cetera, et cetera. I have no idea how you went, sort of how this book ends, and then where you are now. So where are you now? You've got a family. Do you have children shooting each other with BB guns? Are you homeschooling? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I have five children, four girls and a boy, which is kind of the opposite of how I grew up. It was all brothers and cousins, very, very male dominated in my growing up years. And so I did not expect to have all these girls. But yeah, they're all at home still. The oldest is 14. We're homeschooling them. The youngest is 4, so she hasn't really started. You know, I kind of dropped out of culture, pop culture, in 2008. So I've, you know, you're talking about the takeover of the internet. I love how you set that up, because I've never had a smartphone, and now it's like a purposeful thing. I don't want to have to work all the time. I would never get left alone by my job at Colby Academy if I had a phone on me all the time. So I don't own a cell phone. And I think that was a big part of when I moved to Germany. I didn't need it. So I moved to Germany in 2008, and we stayed there for 10 years. So a whole decade gone. And when I came back to the US, I just felt this big change in everything. I mean, I was still, I remember before 2018, a little bit earlier, I was visiting for a summer back in the US, and I went into a Blockbuster Video. I didn't even stream movies or anything. I went into this Blockbuster Video and they were closing. Everything was like empty. And I just felt so out of it. Like, what has happened here? And self-checkouts at the grocery store, I didn't know how to use them. I'm like, this is amazing. Like, people do, they trust them? They're not just stealing things? How do they know?
And you were gone then. So if I'm remembering correctly, so I don't know if people are listening, I don't think they can see our videos, but here's my flip phone.
There you go. Yeah.
It's not a page. I look like a page. I can't believe you even bring up pagers in your first couple pages of this book. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
But I think, so if I remember correctly, you were basically gone for the decade when the iPhone took over, right? Because didn't it come out 2007 or 8 or somewhere around there?
Yeah, I think it did. I think the iPhone 1 came out around there. So I never converted. So I did have
gone.
I had a little flip phone before I left, before I went to Germany, but I never got anything else since then. I think that's made a big difference. So my wife has a phone, and it's a little bit selfish. A lot of people say, like, they're like, "Oh, I envy you for not having a phone now." But it's because I can rely on anybody around me. I'm like, "Oh, can you take a picture of that and email it to me?" And whatever. So it can become a little bit selfish.
I don't need GPS. I don't need GPS. Everyone else has it, right? I'm amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I do talk in the book about wanting to come home to homeschool the kids. That was really the thing. I mean, I loved Germany. We were content on staying there and just living there forever. But it was the schooling part of it that sort of drove us away, where it was like our kids are, you know, by force of law going to school in Germany. And I wanted them to homeschool and get some of the experiences that I had had. And my wife is from a completely different background. She's a city girl, went to public school, all of that. So it's been an adjustment for her, but we see it as the best. I mean, we're homeschooling our five kids, and it's a busy time, but that's what we're up to.
All right. So that's what I want to, I don't know if I set it up correctly. The reason for those of us, I think people that probably listening to this podcast, there's probably a lot of homeschoolers out there, or maybe those that are sympathetic towards it. And your book is also this transition to homeschooling. Cause I mean, in the 80s and 90s, there wasn't a lot of homeschooling, especially now, and especially, you know, post COVID. I mean, it's exploding. For better or worse, because it's exploding in the internet age. And in other posts that I work with, it's called Fraternus. You know, it's all about mentoring young men and helping men, young men become mature, helping boys become men, right? And I actually increasingly am skeptical of the homeschool world, not because I don't believe we're homeschooling, we're doing it. But in a lot of instances, what it's doing to boys can actually be problematic, because it is so dominated by mothers, which I'm not saying anything wrong with that, except when there is, which is when they're kind of stuck at home on an island with mom, like Telemachus waiting for Odysseus to get home so he can have an adventure. You know, a lot of them are sitting inside, sort of surrounded by the bullies of the world, you know, eating up the storehouse and they're, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Cause you're like, yeah, I wrote this book about how I was homeschooled, but your mother is this, I don't know if it's, I wouldn't call it reckless, but this idea, you homeschooled them, homeschooling you then was an adventure, an uncharted pioneering of something new, at least in that era. I mean, it would have been unheard of. I don't want to just rehash stories from the book, but the hilarious, when you are realizing you're not going to have to get on the school bus, and you want the other students to see, and how even the school bus driver is incredulous, and you're like yelling, tripping over yourself in the bushes, I'm not going. And it's hilarious. I read that out loud to my wife. I grew up a little bit of private, little bit of Catholic school when I, but I was not a Catholic then, and that's kind of another story, but mostly public school. I would say basically an only child with a fairly significant benign neglect from my parents. My parents were divorced. You know, maybe they were distracted with other things, or maybe they just gave me a lot of whatever it was. When I got home, my wife says, I don't even know how you made it through school, because I never did anything like homework until my intellectual life did not wake up. Now I have a master's, but it didn't wake up until I became a Catholic in 2021. But before that, it was very much, I mean, the woods, the BB guns, the forts, the adventures was my entire life. So that I was really relating. And I keep bringing up the BB gun. I think I'm even going to title this, because I had not read someone. It sounds like just, I think to somebody, it might just sound like reckless stupidity of just shooting each other BB guns. But there was, when you described the order that must be formed, and the trust and the mistrust and the violation of how many pumps are acceptable and all.
Yeah.
There was some real formation for me going into that. Anyway, what I want to ask you about though, is, are you, your experience of homeschooling, because now you're an educator, right? Yeah. I mean, you're in education. Mm-hmm. Your experience of homeschooling doesn't sound like what I hear a lot of homeschoolers are doing. What is, so now that you're in education, you're in homeschooling, you're working with Colby Academy, you're at Magdalene, may she rest in peace. You're experiencing probably a lot of homeschoolers coming through. And I think of educators like John Senior, who was very skeptical of homeschoolers, even though probably the homeschool world is the biggest reader of John Senior now. What would be some of the biggest like problems that you're seeing in homeschooling that's very different from your experience of, you know, Indians and justice and BB guns?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, I think it's over schooling. Too much schooling is something that we don't talk about it. And it, you know, it hurts our institutions. If somebody goes to Colby Academy, there is, we want them to take as many courses as much as we can. We keep them very busy and all of that. And I've always, since my time there, and a lot of people there would disagree with me, you know, I'm pushing for like private time, for the chance to go on these adventures as students. And, you know, there is something that we have at Colby. We call it the Embrace the Fifth Day. And that means like Fridays should be pretty free for students to just go do whatever they want, go to a museum or something with their families. But my girls who are doing Colby online, you know, they're spending a lot of Friday doing homework. So I think I was basically unschooled. I mean, my mom, as you mentioned, my portrayal of her, I'm surprised she likes it, actually. I had to run the chapters by different people in the family to make sure, because there are times in there where she just looks like a really young, irresponsible mother, just letting us out there throwing knives, shooting BB guns, and, you know, being gone all day. And that freedom was very important to my own formation. And there's a time, you know, it's like diagramming sentences. I hate diagramming sentences. I hate students doing it. I think it's just another form. And people will disagree. They'll show how valuable something like that is. But I'm like, I didn't do anything like that until much later. I didn't even learn the languages that I teach professionally now, Greek and Latin, until I was in graduate school. So there, sure, I would have liked to learn them younger, maybe. But on the other hand, I don't know if I would trade that for the freedom that I got, the freedom that I was allowed. This idea of self-education, discovering your own limits, discovering the dangers without being told, you know, that's too far. We worked it out. We worked it out ourselves.
The desire for this hyper-control, it grates on me. I'm a recovering libertarian, you know, by nature, meaning, you know, so that's a whole nother podcast, but, you know, we need one another, and it's not, you know, don't tread on us is acceptable. But I'm also recognizing that I was unschooled because I sort of rejected school and nobody was paying attention. And so there's a case to be made that I was headed towards disaster. And there was times in my life, except for the God's grace and good mentors, I would have been headed, or I was, I'm sorry, I was in disaster, knee deep, waist deep, chest deep. And, but the adventure, part of it was necessary. And I mean, when people ask me like, what do you do? I'm primarily a writer and an editor. I am so unqualified for this. I've fallen into it. I don't know how I come in and they're actually diagramming sentences. Like, I have no idea. I edit a magazine. I have no idea how to do it. And I have a friend. He's not too far from here. Joseph Pierce. He's on the back of your boat.
Yeah.
And he, you know, my wife was asking him about that. Like, do you teach grammar directly? And he said something to the effect of, you know, some people just get it and they get it from experience. And my education, if you could call it that, was so much like yours, of just almost reckless, benign. And I think because, I don't know if listeners have noticed, but we're both males, that to be a boy and to have the freedom necessary to experience and pursue these interests, and I think you can safely call, especially your book, obsessions, and to have the adventures and the dangers. I think in one of John Senior's books, he says, these homeschooling families send their students to me as panty waists, I believe he calls them, wrapped up in the pretty little age of 12, never growing up and having, you know, being able to get into adventures and danger and love. So the experience of just going, I mean, I remember going out, we would go camping and have no idea what the forecast would be and be just completely woefully unequipped. And we're probably 2 miles into the woods or something. And then it just starts pouring rain and we have no tent. We're like making, I can't imagine not having those things. So I have five boys. I have 8 children. 5 of them are boys, and there was 5 in a row. So we had a decade of savagery in boys. I don't know. You know, I grew up as an only child, not a Catholic. So I'm not purporting to know what I'm doing. But we certainly have on our farm people come over, and they're shaken because they're like grabbing my attention and, hey, that 5-year-old over there has a machete, and I'm like, or no, one of them came up to my son and says, what are you doing with that giant knife or sword? And he looked at her like she was insane. He said, it's a machete. He's very upset by this. And my son has a forge and all this stuff. So I think it has something to do with you were a boy and you needed that. And when you talk about overeducation, tell me more about how you understand this balance. Cause I think it's not a tension between my wife and I, it's in a good way. You know, she's sort of bringing them in and culturing and nurturing and teaching them. And I'm dragging them out and handing them weapons and sending them into the woods between self-education. Because I think that's what I was going to mention. I'm glad you brought it up. It's on page 5, I think. The thin line running through our own history is an increasing confidence in the value of self-education. An education that must be based on one's unique strengths and interests. Time is needed for self-education, generous and without distractions. So you've got a bunch of girls. So tell me, tell me more of your philosophy and thought on, all right, should we be treating boys and girls different, especially when it comes to giving them this free time to in their interests and obsessions?
Well, I've noticed with my own kids, how they spend it is different, of course, like between my son and the way that my daughter see. Like my son is, he just turned 8. He's obsessed with making all these weapons that he's wanting to fight a bear. We live up in New Hampshire and he wants to make these weapons to go fight a bear, you know? And so I just let him, and he makes a huge mess in the garage with all these nails and stuff. And my wife's a little bit, she didn't have any brothers or anything. So she's kind of like, is that okay that he's doing that? So I'm always advocating for it. Like, let him, yeah, he's fine. He's fine. She's more like things need to be a little more structured. She doesn't like the chaos, but I'll tell you, with my girls, they're excellent musicians. We got them piano lessons and stuff, and they will spend, the older two girls will spend, I mean, 5-7 hours a day sometimes writing music, writing. My 11-year-old wrote an entire musical that's legit good. Like, we're going to try to get someone to do it. It's called Salem. And it's about the witch trials, but she wrote all the music, all the spoken parts, all of that. And she did that over the summer. And I'm like, look, if we said we want her to learn how to do this, and we need to take these courses, we need to send her to like learn how to write music and learn how to actually structure a musical, it wouldn't have happened. I mean, what she did though was, yeah, she imitated creatively. So the other person that endorsed the book, Anthony Esselin, who lives here in New Hampshire, he's right over the hill from me. He was teaching writing classes here at Magdalene, and his thought, I'm not quoting him because I didn't hear him say it, but students told me that he said, find writers that you like and imitate them. So I think there's so much in self-education and in education in general that belongs to the realm of imitation. And in my book, I talk a lot about learning all the things that were most important to me, which were little things like hunting, skinning rabbits, fishing, from my old man neighbor. So I really looked up to this guy. And so in that sense, it's the same with boys and girls, in that the girls are imitating things that they really like, which happen to be music and performance and things like that. Whereas my son is looking on how to make weapons, how to, he's kind of like me. He wants to be like an Indian out in the woods or something like that. And so in those ways it's different, but they'll both soak up the boys and girls will soak up the private time. And I think it's very important. So I'm the advocate for that. And my wife is the advocate for structure. And so there's some kind of balance. My growing up was not balanced at all, but theirs is a little more balanced, and maybe that's better. We'll have to see.
I like how you say that so soberly. We had no balance completely. Yeah, the stories of your mom, like she's like trying to teach you something and throws her hands in the air. Just get out of the house. That's
exactly.
I'm trying to tell my wife, like, just do that. On those days where it's going, just send them out here.
Yeah.
Well, one thing you're bringing up, and we, Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say to the listeners, not to worry too much. I mean, think about like the setting. You were right when you say like this was very pioneering for my parents to do this. It was very radical at that time. Now I feel like the homeschooling movement is becoming a little safe. Like you don't have to worry about anything. We've got the institutions which will take care. We've got the curriculum for you. We'll take care of everything. But there was something in that radicalness that made it vibrant, I think. But to anyone out there, no matter how you're doing it, you're going to be fine. It's going to work out okay. Read the book and you'll see that my mom was not qualified. Everything turned out pretty much okay, I think.
Yeah. I think, well, that word safe, that really, I don't know. That's something's become safe in a way that's bad.
Yeah.
And one thing though, I think it's fair to say, maybe we should give you and I, this almost seems luxurious because the setting that we were not in was the modern suburbia. Yeah. I think that, and it provides a different encounter. And my reflection on that has been, you know, the first neighborhood I lived in, was actually between my father and my uncle had renovated this old, like, I guess they're called townhomes. I don't know what it looks like, a castle made of stone, and it was between two Section 8 housing units. And if you don't know what Section 8 housing, it's the projects, it's government funded, low income, predominantly Black, housing. And those were all my friends. I was the only white kid on the block. Across the street from this was acres and acres of woods. So I'm like the only white kid, you know, I got beat up plenty, acres and acres of woods. The next neighborhood I lived in was a trailer park and full of like the most interesting characters. I mean, you have your neighbor that you learned a lot from, and then you felt bad when you shot him. The other day, my kids love to hear these like ridiculous stories I have of setting off an MA man's front porch and watching him come out, but he had like tongue cancer. So when he yelled, his tongue was just swollen and he couldn't speak to us, but he would drive, I guess, cause he was a drunkard and lost his license. He would drive this lawnmower with a trailer up back, and he had a trailer on the back. On the back of the lawnmower. And he'd go to the store. We'd hop in the back and just ride, see where he's going. And he loved it. You know, these kids. And that sounds like if you try to describe that, if you were speaking at a homeschool conference, well, what you need to do is find a drunkard in a trailer that drives to the liquor store and I'm riding in the back of this, but I can't imagine life without these adventures.
Yeah.
And then now we live, and for a little while later, probably like 15 through 18, I lived in a suburb, predominantly white, upper middle-class suburb, and I can never do it again. So the reason I'm bringing that up, the safety thing, cause now we live on, we live on a farm in Western North Carolina. This is where I'm from, North Carolina. And one thing about your book that I don't know if you've thought about or if you've spoken about this that's different is that you are in a place that allows for adventure and danger in a way that's beautiful. And I think that's what I'm very grateful now that we're able to be in a place where we have this, our neighbors, my kids have the drunkard neighbor that, and he's a golden, but they see he's a golden heart. His place is a total disaster, but he remembers all of my children's name, all eight of them, in their middle names, in their birthdays. And he's just this giant glowing heart. But if anyone looked at if they drove by his place, it'd be oozing with judgment. So I'm grateful for that. But tell me about your experience though. Your place was so different. So have you tried to recreate it, or are you just in some like vanilla boring suburb, or like how have you reconciled that?
It's very different. So as I describe in the book, I was out way out on the eastern prairie in a drive past town. I mean, it was my brother tells me don't ever go back because it'll ruin it for you, because it really is. I tried to make my place look beautiful. And I still have this attachment to it. I talk to people that are there that have read my book, and they appreciate most of what I said. I think kind of putting it on the map a little bit, because it's just this tiny little place out in the prairie. But where I am now is a little New Hampshire village called Warner, which is where Magdalene. That's why we moved here. Is Magdalene's right up there. I'm up at Magdalene right now, and the office is, and my house is just down the road. It's not the same. We were able to get, so we have a place in town and we just have like an acre and a half in the back, which was important because I wanted to at least be able to have some small animals and stuff. So we have chickens, and we had goats, and I'd like to get some sheep and stuff. So here where we are, we can at least have that on our land behind us. But I mean, it's a tiny little kind of an idyllic village. People that, and it sounds funny to say village probably to most of the rest of the country, but in New England, you still can use that. But my, you know, we have it to some extent, I guess. It's not what I had though, with just the vast openness where you could just keep going and going and going. But because it's wooded, there's enough. It's a different thing. In a prairie, you need tons and tons of space, but in the woods, you can find a lot of adventures just right around the corner. Yeah. So it's more like that, I would say.
Is that something you've seen though? I mean, when you're working in education, I don't feed the witness here, but my observation is it seems like a deficit, a sense of place where you can actually go out and have adventures. Where there's a little bit of expanse.
And that plays into, you know, the maybe too much schooling or whatever. And I guess I don't want to put that down too much, because there are kids that become, I mean, they're just super individuals as they grow up. I've been teaching at Colby long enough, 10 years now, where I see them become adults and have children and all that. But when they were students, they lived in the suburbs and they did everything in books and online classes and stuff. And I don't think they really saw, I think they live vicariously through my stories, wishing that they had that kind of an upbringing, but they've turned out just fine and they become excellent individuals. But man, I would encourage people, give your kids that chance to just be themselves out in God's green earth and away from technology. I mean, that meant the world.
Yeah, I don't want to feed parents another thing to worry about. Oh no, we're too suburban now. We got to get out and have some adequate danger time. I don't want to do that, but I think it's part of, you know, in your book, when you're on the cusp of the sort of takeover of the internet, and then the adventures of homeschooling and all that, there is something, maybe the thing we're discussing really is just the sort of controlled environment of particularly boys and young men, but of students, and not being able to develop themselves. And that, so inching towards that, you brought up your kids liking weapons. We have a picture of my son when he was 7 or 8, and he's got a bow that he made. And he's looking at the picture, he's looking at the camera, right? You know, like kind of side eye looking at it. And our joke is, now that we look at it, because now he's 13, the joke is, the caption for the picture is, you think this is a phase, because he has endlessly obsessed about making weapons. I'm always like, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, Henry. And he's like, oh, this is my peacemaker, you know? he makes swords. He's got a forge. He's just, you know, ballistas, like all these. I don't even know the lingo. I never had the obsession with weapons outside of some, you know, BB gun, the normal ones, guns and knives. He's got,
theories and all these other things. And think about how much if he just keeps going deeper with that obsession, how much he'll learn. I mean, so often, and especially in liberal arts circles, it's like you need this. They claim this well-rounded education, which is great, and that's what I'm trying to provide for my older daughters. But for me, it was obsessions that where I went deep all the way. When I did my PhD, it was the same thing. It's just going extremely deep in a narrow way. But and that's kind of looked down on, I feel like, in American liberal arts circles somewhat. But I would advocate for it, at least in my own experience, that when you go deep in one area and just keep going, like your son Henry, if he keeps learning more and more, he'll want to know the history of it. He'll learn about like iron and bronze and all these ages and things if he just keeps going. And that's an education that I think is invaluable. So I love the idea of letting people really focus on what they love and just run with it as much as possible.
Yeah, I know the liberal arts circles and, you know, the homeschool world, there's like the Charlotte Mason circles and which I know my wife, a lot of, so we have a lot of literary, you know, it's a very bookish home, household, or have a lot of stories, a lot of ideas. And I think that's where we've, you know, and that's the whole well-rounded thing. You want to give them all these ideas and but I think we've had to learn as they get older, these obsessions are great. I mean, my daughter, my 14-year-old daughter is currently obsessed with cheeses. You know, we have a small dairy, so we milk six Jersey cows. We have great, you know, she's got the resource there. And she's like, you know, just obsessing about cheeses, and this is great. What's the difference? But as you're saying that, I know that in the liberal arts and the, you know, classical world, there's, I think, a good reaction against, you know, the hyper focus on expertise, you know, in the modern, educational world and even the world of work, that we're, you know, experts in this, you know, we become these obsessive experts and we're not well-rounded as adults. But it doesn't seem to be that's what's happening when a child is carried to it. That's not what happened to you when you became obsessed with being an Indian when you were young. Which, by the way, if you please buy this book because it's hilarious. His Jordan's you think you were into being an Indian when you were a little boy, but you need to read this book to understand how obsessed when I picture you walking in wearing your gear to a high school class when you were like in middle school or something and instructing them on the ways of it, yes, knowingly. So anyway, what's the difference between allowing these obsessions to take place? Is that something different from what we're trying to do with students later and making them, you know, hyper-focused experts?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, something that in these, you know, so I'm working the whole gambit from Colby Academy, which starts at kindergarten and goes up through high school, and then also college students here at Magdalen. So I'm seeing, like, you know, I think that the whole movement sometimes gets stuck in a certain stage, which is ask the perennial questions, like, what does it mean to be a human? Let's read the great books that have animated people throughout history and all of that. But my expertise that I, you know, I did in Germany was in early Christianity. So a New Testament and into the, you know, third century or so, fourth century of Christian history. And what we've always seen, and I think it's missing today, is a final stage of Christian paideia, which is towards the Bible. So I think there's a missing element there in Catholic education circles. In fact, I was at a ICLE conference, the national conference, and a question was posed to one of the speakers, how does the Bible fit into our liberal arts curriculum? And he basically said, we don't know, we don't know what to do with the Bible. And I think it's because in our day, we read it as a means to an end. Like here at Magdalen, they'll do New Testament in one semester, Old Testament in one semester, and it's en route to earning this degree in a liberal arts field. Whereas it was never like that in the past. So, and I bring all that up to say that I think sometimes when we start classical so-called education really young, taste of it, and then we do it in high school, and then you go off to college, and maybe you do it again in college, reading always the great books, there isn't an arrival to what was always seen up at least until the scholastic period as the actual, like, capstone of a true Christian education, was using all the tools of the liberal arts and philosophy to inform biblical studies. And so I like the idea
that you could read the Bible.
So that you could read the Bible. Yeah. That was the one revealed text in history, the divinely inspired, that reads all other literature. And so I'm kind of pushing for that, like the idea of that you know, that there is an end to these perennial questions from the pagan period and all of that they inform our biblical understanding. And it seems like there is some momentum in American Catholicism with, you know, the Bible in a Year podcast. I don't really listen to it, but I know a lot of people that do. And I think there's a lot of good resources like that coming back. But we always put the Bible alongside all the other great books. And I would love to see this shift to where, no, you study the liberal arts to get to the Bible.
Wow. That's fascinating. Cause I mentioned I'm a convert. Well, my family was not, I didn't grow up anything, just kind of the Christ haunted South, as Flannery O'Connor put it. But then I became a serious Protestant in, you know, middle of high school. and then later became a Catholic. But my time as a Protestant was very formative because of the intense study and attachment to scripture. I mean, I can't believe in such a short time in sort of a Protestant ethos, how much of the scripture I came to know and love and sort of just have it as a, and my wife, she had a similar conversion. We were kind of in similar time together, you know, reading and studying the scripture and stuff. So we sort of have this as a language and an understanding. It's funny you said that, because we bring up a lot that it doesn't, I'm not sure in sort of all this classical and homeschooling world, they're not having that sort of sense of this arch text of that's divinely inspired, that's set apart and completely different. It is sort of in the mix. And I was on this past year, we read a really great book, but it was a, I won't name it in case, you know, I don't know, the publisher gets upset or something, but it was sort of a retelling of scripture. And I thought, well, they're not even learning the language of, you know, some of this, just reading it directly. It's all this retelling and the narrative, all this, which I get, but just, so anyway, that's a fascinating insight. It's not how I was expecting you to answer that, but do you have any advice or any experience as far as making, I don't know, the scriptures, it's like how to not make it just another topic, how to make it the arch text of the homeschool.
Yeah, I think there's going to have to become some sort of, so I individually, it could be done. Individually, it could, like individual families, if they can just place, so the idea that was always there until this, like, you know, 50-year experiment that we've basically had in the recovery with John Sr. and Thomas Aquinas College and these other movements, Colby Academy in 1980, like these movements to recover liberal education, as they call it, liberal education for the free man, like all of that. I think it has to eventually be seen as a first step towards a true recovery of Christian paideia. So if you read, you know, St. Augustine, St. Jerome, like all these, you know, so every, all those fathers of the fourth century, they all saw that the Bible, knowledge of the scriptures was the end game, of course. So what you had was, in Greek paideia, you had this idea of liberal arts, which are the skills, the tools, grammar, logic, rhetoric. So you learn these in order to study philosophy. And that relegates then the liberal arts to being a pro paideia. So that means it's like a prerequisite, basically. So you learn the liberal arts, you move into the next stage, which would be philosophy. And so what happened after Christ, though, as early as the first century, second century, really, but I'm sure you see it in St. Paul as well, is then philosophy is relegated to a pro paideia for biblical exegesis, which is the top one. So I think in individual homeschooling families, they could probably do that in a way. You'd have to figure it out your own way, but I think you could use the Bible as the arch text, you know, your senior year, your junior year, or something like that, possibly. Like it's what you're leading to. And then you really, the difficult thing though is as we know from church teaching, that it's hard to understand the Bible without a teacher, especially, I did the same. I've read the Bible incessantly as a Protestant. So I was always looking for theology and these different things, but it is a different thing to read it as a Catholic. It's an awesome, unbelievable thing. It's like I'm discovering everything new now. And, you know, it's like when Philip in the book of Acts sees the Ethiopian reading Isaiah and he says, "Do you understand what you're reading?" He says, "How can I without a teacher?" And then Philip expounds the scriptures for him. Well, the papal documents that are calling for this, you know, laity to read the Bible, they always cite that passage in the idea that you know, you need a teacher, you need something like that. So I think in the end, what's going to have to happen, and I hope I'm a part of it, is to have institutions, and there are some out there, but I think it could be done in an even better way, Catholic institutions of the Bible, where it's taking all this preparation in liberal arts, the pro paideia of philosophy, the preparation in philosophy, the pro paideia for biblical studies, and then that's a real destination. So you read all the great books or whatever. That's been the challenge at little places like Magdalen and Christendom, people I've talked to in these different institutions, is convincing students to read the great books again in college. So my solution is, why don't we read the great book? Why isn't there a great book college that we can, you know?
Yeah. That's once again where I think I could relate to your experience. I mean, I'm an armchair theologian at best, and you're a scholar. But when I went to graduate school and had Catholic teachers, because I had good teachers as a Protestant, I didn't just read the, Protestants really don't just read the Bible. They do a lot of Bible studies, mm-hmm. With people. And there's usually there are some reckless Bible studies out there, which are just people opening the Bible and they're not formed in it well, and they don't have good theology, and they come up with disastrous things and start a new church, but there's teachers, but reading it, having good mentors and guides as a process, but then becoming a Catholic and having it unlocked in a very scholarly graduate level was my could not believe the coherence and the beauty of the scriptures. And it's life changed to this day. It sort of brought it into that aha moment of wholeness, which I hope that Lord help me be some sort of form of wisdom given to us, from the scriptures.
I'm sure it was, because I would say Clement of Alexandria has this great quote where he calls knowledge of the scriptures the shortest path to truth. And I think I mm-hmm. probably took that same mm-hmm. journey like you did, where, I went to Germany and studied in a Protestant faculty with a very skeptical Protestant, well-known professor. It led me to Catholicism. And from the Bible, I've read out to everything else, which is kind of the opposite of what we're providing our Catholic students. It's like you read the other stuff first. Yeah. But I think that road for some of us converts.
I'm sorry. I got to stop. That's exactly my experience, actually, yeah. is now I'm reading. And in fact, because is all the romance of my freedom as a child. I did not. My wife was like, she always thought, didn't you read this when you were a kid? I'm like, no, sweetie, I can't express this enough. I didn't read anything. Okay. Yeah. I just played in the woods. That is all I did. Mm-hmm. But now, and then I had the conversion, the scriptures became important, went to graduate school. And now I'm with my family, where I'm sort of going in that direction too. And it's beautiful. It's I don't know. Maybe it's a better way. You should consider, promoting that even more, or at least not making people again feel worried that their kids are not, reading Greek classics in the sixth grade.
Right.
But hey, you know what the problem is now? We're going over our normal time, this podcast length. And so we're gonna have to do it some more. Because I need to get to a final question. See, I can tell I got you to your true passion of the scriptures now at the end. So that's, you started going with it, but I have to return to some previous passions, which is, do you advise that homeschool families allow their children, particularly their sons, to shoot each other with BB guns?
Well, the way I say it in my book is I ask the question to myself at the end of that chapter that describes the war, and I say, what are you doing? Are you telling people to shoot another generation of boys to shoot their eyes out with BB guns? And then I say, no, but I am advising them to shoot their fear out in some way. So, something that you feel uncomfortable with. It doesn't have to be risking eyes and BB guns and stuff, but not to be so afraid. I guess.
Fair enough. And just so everyone knows, I'd like to wrap up, but that what you just said, you'll shoot your eye out. We're coming off of Christmastide when we're recording this, and A Christmas Story. If anyone hasn't read the Little House books in it, but they have seen, perhaps you had the poor formation like I did, but you've seen A Christmas Story over and over, year after year. The way that Ralphie describes boyhood so accurately, his sense of justice, his desire for retribution. I think that's why that movie is so classic, is it gets in the mind of the boy. Everything from your story of the boy who wants to take your rock that he doesn't appreciate adequately, to the hilarity of the British man showing up to breakfast. I won't reveal too much, but less than dressed. All of those things. I do want to encourage anyone listening to Till and Keep. If you grew up and you're like me, a dad from the 90s, now you're homeschooling and you're feeling nostalgic and you want some of these things explained and they are important, and you were on the cusp of something, and it's important for you to recall it accurately. I highly recommend the book again, When the Earth Was Flat, One Boy's Life on the Edge of the Millennium by Jordan Almanzar, and by Colby Academy Press is the publisher, who's been my guest today on Till and Keep. I appreciate it so much. I think we'll have to do it again, because Or maybe not, because we have a lot in common. So we'll just ramble about what we like, and it would make for a bad podcast or good podcast. I don't know how this podcast stuff works. I don't have a smartphone. So anyway, Jordan, thank you so much. Any parting words of advice?
No, I want to thank you, Jason. And I guess the words of advice is just keep going. Just keep going. If you've started on this journey, don't be afraid. God will be with you, and keep going. You'll be fine. Thanks, Jason.
Oh, all right. Thanks, Jordan. All right, this has been Till and Keep Podcast. Thank you for listening.
This episode of Till and Keep has been brought to you by TAN, Fraternus, and Sword and Spade. Till and Keep is a podcast that shows how the primordial command from God to Adam to till and keep the garden applies whether you toil on a farm or in a concrete jungle. Visit tillandkeeppodcast.com to subscribe and follow the show, and use coupon code TILL25 to get 25% off your next order at tanbooks.com.